Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mary Roach, whose latest book is titled Gulp, Earlier Books, Packing for Mars, Spook, Bonk, and Stiff. And Mary Roach deals with subjects in a popular manner that most of us kind of want to know about but kind of don't want to know about. And Gulp is about the alimentary canal. I understand that you got the original idea when you were looking through Lancet magazine.
I came across, when I was doing Packing for Mars, I came across a study that was done on the Berkeley campus in the 60s, the nutrition department. People were thinking about, oh, we're going to go to Mars pretty soon here, was the thinking. And what can we feed people on this two-year mission? You know, you can't bring boxes of food. You want to be able to grow something. What's easy to grow? And somebody got the bright idea that, wow, we could feed them dead bacteria, like a stew, a soup, a puree of dead bacteria. And they actually brought people into there's a metabolic chamber in the nutrition science department here at Berkeley. And they set them up with these plates of dead bacteria. And by way of how it went, the title of the paper is Human Intolerance to Bacteria as Food. It did not go well at all. We do not want to eat dead bacteria.
So you saw this article while you're working on Packing for Mars, and that put the idea in your brain.
It just made me think that the science of eating, because we think of eating and food tends to be almost in the realm of art in our culture. Food is an art, cooking and food. And I thought, well, no, you don't really hear much about the science of taking in nutrients and processing them and chewing them up. I mean, that seems to be something we as humans would rather turn away from. And so not much is written on it. And I thought, this is a job for Mary Roach.
Well, when you started, the book itself begins with the sense of smell, which is at one end and ends at the other, correct?
Yes.
That meant you had to make a lot of decisions on what you would include and what you wouldn't. How did that go? Was it just simply whatever you found that really intrigued you went in, pretty much?
Pretty much. That is how it works, yes, which is, I admit, an indulgent way to write a book. I think if I were a different person, I would have perhaps had an entire chapter on the liver. I would have covered bile. I would have covered gluten sensitivity. I would have covered a lot of things that just didn't really pique my interest as much as some of the other things that I came across. So it is a very quirky biography, I guess you'd say, of the alimentary canal.
A lot of it has to do with weird scientific stuff from the 19th century. And it seems that that's a thread running through most of your books. They're not Packing for Mars necessarily, but in the other books that it seems to be a thread. What is it about 19th century science that so intrigues you?
You know what it is? That's the era when nobody knew how anything worked. You took something, everything was on a much, you know, a more macro scale. Now we're down in the molecular level. We're looking at protein receptors and genes. And it used to be someone could just say, you know, this thing, the stomach, how does that work? What's in there? What are those juices? What are they made of? How do they work? How do they emotions affect them? So the science was on a very human scale. When I say human, I mean the whole human organism. We hadn't sort of dived down into the microscope. It was science that you could see. You could paint a picture of it. You could go and see people doing things. Now a lot of it is happening under a microscope, and it's a little less fun. As a writer, you can't really paint the pictures the same way. You don't have the same narratives.
There's also the element of hubris. These people did some very, very bizarre things, cutting holes into stomachs to look inside. This one guy, Beaumont, cut into the stomach of a guy named St. Martin, tortured him, and then stalked him.
That's one way to look at it. I don't think Beaumont would phrase it quite that way, but it wasn't interesting. I was interested, yes, in the relationship between these two. The year was 1822 when the hole first appeared. The hole was the result of an accident. It was a rifle. Beaumont did not shoot the rifle. Beaumont was off the scene at the time, but it was an accidental shooting. So there's the guy with the hole in his side, which isn't healing well. It's healing as a gastrocutaneous fistula, which is an unnatural opening from the stomach to the outside world. And at a certain point, our friend Beaumont, he's the doctor, fur, American Fur Company. The young boy with the hole in the stomach is a trapper. Beaumont's a army surgeon nearby. So he treats the boy. He realizes this hole is not healing. How hard he tried to heal that is a matter of conjecture. How he says he did everything in his power. But at a certain point, a light bulb goes off over William Beaumont's head, and he realizes, I can use this hole as a literal window onto human digestion. I can figure out, is it a chemical process or a mechanical process? What are those chemicals? Are they doing the work, or are the contractions doing the work? I can take the juice out. I can put it in a test tube. I can have it strapped to his underarm while he wanders around the house. So this boy, Alexis St. Martin, was employed as a sort of a professional stomach. He was paid. He signed a contract at one point. He was volunteering for it, but at the same time, he'd get fed up and he'd take off and then
fed up.
Yeah, fed up. I can't. Everything now is a pun. I'm making them right and left, and I don't even. I don't mean to do it. Anyway, so Beaumont and St. Martin were biology's oddest couple.
The 19th century also produced some very strange ideas about chewing, that somebody would have to chew for a half hour in order to fully digest their food. Again, it all seems to be arrogance. People who don't know anything making these, saying, I'm a scientist, and suddenly coming up with these outlandish theories.
Yeah, the extreme chewer was Horace Fletcher. And Fletcherization, well, it hit its peak around 1910 or so, and it was a national craze. There were chewing parties. There were songs written about that you could, well, I don't know who you'd sing while you were chewing. But Horace Fletcher, he was independently funded. He did not have an MD. He had friends in high places, including scientists, and he convinced them of this theory that if you chewed your food extremely thoroughly, we're talking sometimes 700 chews per mouthful of something, of vegetable matter, for example, if you chewed it very, very, very thoroughly, that you would extract almost double the nutrients and the calories and the protein. He was overlooking the role of the stomach, which, as Beaumont, our friend Beaumont with the hole, had actually proved earlier, the stomach does a very good job of reducing food to liquid, with a couple of exceptions which pass on down the line undigested. He's not an MD. He doesn't have a PhD or any kind of background in physiology. It just seemed intuitive to him, and it seemed intuitive to a lot of people, to like, hey, it seems like I'd get more nutrition and could save money on the grocery bill. And it caught on. I mean, all the way to the level of the U.S. military was instructing soldiers to Fletcherize so that the people who had to buy the food for the troops could spend less money. It became this way to feed the poor for less money. You know, let them chew cake. We can feed them a lot less. You people just need to chew more. Some of the people who took up Fletcherizing, Franz Kafka, that astounded me. Now that image, you know, that image, iconic image of Kafka with the cheekbones and the eyes, and now I kind of picture him laboriously, grimly chewing for hours at the dinner table.
Mary Roach, I want to kind of expand this to talk more generally, but we'll also hit some specifics. When you walk into a subject like Gulp, you're also walking into the world of nutritionists. You're walking into the world of a lot of experts. Did you have some experts on the side that you could constantly call, or were you just heading to the library and seeing what you could dig up?
I'm always heading to the library. That's part of the joy. I love mucking around in medical school libraries and here on the Berkeley campus as well. But I did have, there's a gastroenterologist that I kept trying to compensate him, because at a certain point, when you've written, emailed and called someone 15 times with questions, you can make a real pest of yourself. And he was incredibly patient. He said, no one asks me these questions. And so it's kind of fun to get, like, I would write him a note and say, Mike, is it actually possible to knock the out of someone? Is that something you would actually do? Like, I would come to him with these questions that he had no reason to think about day to day on his job as a gastroenterologist. So he kind of got a kick out of it, but he was tremendously helpful. I had him read the book in its entirety just to go over it, because I don't have a background in physiology, anatomy, and I'm always on thin ice a little bit. I tend to dive into little slivers of subject matter that I can become well versed in, but then if you wander off to either side of those little slivers, then I'm I'd need to go and ask more questions of learned people because I don't have that background.
There's a section on saliva and two different kinds of saliva, which I didn't know about. There's the kind you normally have in your mouth and then the kind you have when you're hungry. Obviously, this kind of turns one off to kissing. How do you feel about that at the time as you're working on it?
Actually, there's unstimulated, which is the background stuff that keeps everything moist. And that's the icky one. The one that happens when you are chewing or it's called stimulated saliva, and it can be stimulated by chewing. By acid stimulates the flow because you need to bring the pH to a safe level. But that, I was in the lab of a woman who studies saliva, and we collected some stimulated saliva, and there's a way you can do it where you chew on a cotton plug, and your body's like, okay, I guess you want to swallow that plug, so it's cranking out the saliva, and then you centrifuge it, and we wound up with a little glass beaker about an inch high with saliva, and it's looks, tastes, smells, everything like water. It's actually not off-putting at all. The background kind that gets the kind of mucilaginous sort of. But what's interesting about it, even though it's essentially water, it's got minerals, it's got enzymes and other things, but 90-something% water, 99% water. But try to get somebody, even a saliva researcher, to drink that water, and nobody will. Nobody will. It is an extraordinary taboo surrounds saliva, but only once it leaves your mouth because you're drinking it all day long.
But the other thing about it, of course, is that it's this great antibacterial. It kills everything.
Yeah, that was astounding to me. Because if you look back in the folk medicine remedies from the 1700s, 1600s, they'll say, like, even not just saliva, but fasting saliva, which would be just very dry and stringy and hideous, but they'll say that, you know, that would be something you'd rub into a wound or a chancre to promote healing, and that's something that there's actually truth to that. If you prevent an animal from licking its wound, specific animals, and they haven't tested, you know, giraffes, but this was a rodent study. But if you prevent an animal from licking the wound, it heals more slowly, and wounds in the mouth heal more quickly than wounds on the skin. So there's specific things in there that promote the skin growth and nerve growth and wound closure. So it's kind of amazing stuff. Someone should really bottle it.
Little kids, for instance, will tend to lick their boo-boos, you know. And we always say, don't do it. You'll get it dirty. But maybe they should.
Yeah. Well, it's almost, when you prick your finger with a needle or something, it's almost an instinct to put it to your mouth,
right? Yeah.
Then lick it off. There was a study, the Journal of Emergency Medicine, I believe it was, looked at human bites, 50 cases of them that weren't treated with antibiotics, and only one in those 50 became infected. There was an assumption that, you've got to really give them a lot of antibiotics, but in fact, it proved not to be the case.
Now, what about a dog bite then?
If there's any concern about rabies, that would be it. That would be a.
But that means that if your dog comes up and licks you, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's a good thing, obviously, but it may be a better thing.
It may be a better thing than you think. No, that's true. And saliva, and the other thing that is amazing about saliva is that, this isn't that amazing. It's more just sort of fascinating that laundry detergent, when, you know, they say enzymatic action, the enzymes in laundry detergent, Those are enzymes from one of them is saliva, two of them are saliva, and digestive tract. That's lipase, amylase, and proteinase breaks down starch, fat, protein. Because the same food that you're putting in your mouth, you're also dropping on your pants. So it makes perfect sense. Somebody had the bright idea, let's put some digestive enzymes in the detergent, and it works quite well. So if I spill things on myself, I dab saliva on it. That's just the kind of weirdo I am. Pre-soak. It's nature's own pre-soak.
You're listening to an interview with Mary Roach, whose latest book is titled Gulp. Mary Roach, what kinds of questions did you ask that you couldn't get an answer to?
I didn't get a satisfactory answer to the question, what are the sounds? There's a word, intestinal sounds. There's a wonderful word, borborygmi, which is the grumblings and noises of the rumblings of the intestines, of the digestive tract. Borborygmi is a wonderful word to say, but I asked the gastroenterologist, said, oh, you know, there's the contractions and the stuff that's in there is sloshing back and forth and here and there. But if you put your ear to someone's belly, there's some very specific sounds in there that I would love to have a better sense of exactly what is causing those sounds. There's an iPhone app with stomach sounds, intestinal rumblings, borborygmi, as it were. And I had hoped to take those and sort of plug them into a speaker and have them playing in the background at my book talk, but they don't sound right. Nobody really managed to capture borborygmi as they sound to the human ear pressed up against the stomach.
Going through all your research, what areas did you decide not to cover, not because they didn't interest you, but because the book would have been just too damn long?
Weight, anything relating to weight, anything relating to inflammatory bowel disease, colitis, Crohn's, anytime that there's any autoimmune disorders that relate to the small or large intestine, that is just a whole other world, and it's also related to emotional state and stress, and so I tried to keep the focus on the healthy equipment because there's so many other books, and also I don't have an MD, and that material is changing so fast. I did talk a little about fecal transplants because I was discussing the microbiome, all the bacteria in the colon that are normally there and healthily there, so I did go off into that realm, and that is used to treat a bacterial infection. But by and large, I was trying to stick to the healthy tube.
That particular transferring bacteria into the intestine, it sounds like pretty easy, fairly inexpensive, kind of an easy thing to do and quite effective. Yet the sense I get in the book is that it's not pursued because there's no way to do it outside the body. It has to be done by somebody. And nobody wants to cover it.
The chapter is called The Ick Factor. But it's only partly the ick factor. I mean, there was sort of a natural reluctance to embrace this technique. The technique is it's a fecal transplant, and it is pretty much what it sounds like. You take a donor, just a healthy person's stool. There's different ways to do it. The way I saw it involves just an Oster blender and some water, and you take it, run it over quickly as you can because you don't know how long these bacteria are going to live outside the colon. And you take a colonoscope, which is the tube, the equipment you use for a colonoscopy. You got a plunger attachment, and it's like immigration. You're taking all the bacteria from a healthy person and you're putting it into the intestines of somebody who's got a serious imbalance with a difficult organism called C. difficile, and it's very, very quickly effective and cheap. And one of the reasons the physician I spoke to, I said, is it just the ick factor? And he said, no, it's also because normally there's a profit to be made here if it's off the drug or off a medical device. Here it's just poop. So there's no money to be made here. So and it takes some money to get a procedure established in the healthcare system to get it approved, to get, you know, this isn't a device or a drug, but the FDA is still involved and there's still trials and it has to be safe. And there isn't really that obvious person to spend the money to get it in. I mean, they don't even know how do you bill for a fecal transplant? What do you charge for it? He just bills for a colonoscopy because that's essentially what it comes down to, but it's amazing how long it took. I mean, this technique is agriculture people have done it with cows for decades. The cows, if something's off with a cow, you take a little one cow's manure and you put it in the other, and they've been doing it for a long time and known that it works. And the first fecal transplant was done. Wow, is Ben Eisenman 50s? It's in the book. The exact date I'm forgetting, but anyway, it's been quietly done. And now there's been some major studies that have established the efficacy.
But don't do it at home because...
Well, yeah, don't try this at home. There are people who have tried it at home, and there's ways that you can mess up. Like somebody used tap water, and there's chlorine, which kills the bacteria, so that you don't want to do that. You don't know. Also, you want to make sure you're not introducing some... You know, you have to choose your donor carefully. It's not nobody knows exactly which bacteria you're after, but you also don't want to transplant somebody else's problems.
And you don't necessarily know what they are.
And you don't necessarily know what they are. That's right.
How did you find some of these experts? I mean, you have experts on olive oil tasting. You have experts on a lot of very strange things. How do you track these people down?
Often I'm just stumbling upon them. I just turn over a lot of rocks is what I do. And you read one paper and you'll find a mention in there. For example, the olive, when I was working on the flavor chapter, I was in the world of flavor panels and people who are professional tasters of various weird things. And in one paper, I came across a reference to a human cat food flavor panel. And of course, that took me off in another direction. And so I start my books with no sense of where I'm going, really. I have a very vague sense of what I'll cover. And I let myself be kind of buffeted by the winds of chance and fate. And one researcher will mention some, you know, people are the best resource. So you go and you visit one person and you have a conversation and you learn about something else that you'd never heard of. So and then you go there, and then that person takes you. It's just sort of like a treasure hunt.
And how do you determine what goes into the text and what into the footnotes then?
What goes in is just the stuff that is top of the list in terms of its stuff that is, to me, really interesting. Just interesting or funny. I want it to be stuff that, for the most part, the average person hasn't read something on it before. So I'm looking for unique, funny, strange, and also what's most interesting to me. I guess I have this picture of my audiences, of my readers, as kind of being John Malkovich, you know, the scene where suddenly the whole room is John Malkovich. I guess I just imagine Mary Roach readers as kind of me everywhere. And so I just figure, well, if I find this interesting, you guys will, whoever you guys are.
Well, that's also, I think, the key to all writing is if you know it's interesting to you, then there's a greater likelihood you'll make it interesting to everyone else.
If I'm not finding it interesting, the writing will suffer. It's, you know, if I'm not enthusiastic and having a good time, the reader probably won't either. So, yeah.
Mary Roach, what was the most remarkable thing? I mean, you talk about these really weird things. What was the thing that one or two things that hit you that you didn't know that just made you go, wow, really?
There's always a point in my books where I'm stunned by the fact that there is a whole body of research that somebody, some scientist or some physician decided this would be his world, his or her world of study. Flatulence is something, it's mostly a tee-hee thing. You don't really think that there's been, but through the ages, there have been different devices and methods of, because if you're going to study flatulence, you've got to trap it, collect it, gather it, measure it. So there's people who've applied their own creativity and innovation to coming up with, say, the mylar flatus trapping pantaloon or the rectal tube or the breath hydrogen test, which is a very much more dainty way to do it because you extrapolate from the hydrogen in the exhalation to figure out how much is coming out the other end. So I'm always just amazed that there is a whole history in the book of the study of flatulence dating back to early 1800s, where the French physician was working on. We don't need to go there. But anyway, so I'm always amazed by that. And oral processing, there are these researchers, not all of them in the Netherlands, but the ones that I visited, people studying how you form a bolus in your mouth and what your tongue is doing and swallowing and the fact that there's scientific equipment and studies and people doing PhDs and writing terminology and inventing the tongue camera, that I love.
You know, one thing that struck me was that you have all of these companies that spend all their time and effort creating chemical combinations that will be pleasing that have no relation to anything natural, like Doritos, for instance, or Cheez-Its, I think is
right.
The one you use.
Right. That's right. Yeah, and what is really interesting is to, if it's not easy to do this, but to taste a Dorito without the spray-on coating, or a Cheeto. I met a man who worked for Frito-Lay, I think it was Frito-Lay, and I said, have you tasted the naked Cheeto? And he said, I have. It's like unsweetened puffed rice, which is to say it tastes like nothing. And then he said, and I said, wow, that seems sort of, you're like spraying on taste. And he said, it's called a palatant. And really what you do, a sauce is a human palatant. You take something like chicken, which doesn't on its own have a lot of flavor, and you put the sauce on it. So palatants are a part of our traditional cuisine in this country. The sauce is where the flavor is, and the meat is often we Americans gravitate toward the blandest cuts. You know, there's much more flavor in, you know, the blood, the bone, the fat provide the flavor, that just a breast meat, for example, is not particularly flavorful.
And that, of course, brings in the area of crispiness, which is another thing that we're attracted to. I mean, I was thinking as I was reading that part of the book about what people like and what they don't like, you know, to me, poi, which I've had in Hawaii, looks and tastes like Elmer's glue all that I had when I was a kid. And I'm trying to think of why would somebody find that interesting or good, but that's how we're raised. There's something going on there that has to do with how we're brought up and not our taste buds.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Culture determines what we find disgusting as food or what we find desirable, for sure. And there was a study done in the University of Pennsylvania. Paul Rosen studies disgust, the psychology of disgust. And he makes the point very effectively that we come into the world without a sense of this kind of food is disgusting and this is okay and this is wrong to eat and this is right to eat. We come into the world embracing edible stuff. And you put in front of these kids a sterilized grasshopper, very much a cultural phenomenon. And in this country, you know, we tend to be pretty squeamish and we export all of our the scary parts. And other countries are like, hey, that's the best part. I'll take that.
In the old days, the slaves got certain parts of the pig and the white people got the other part. And eventually, you know, the slaves wound up getting the better part. But what did we know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They get the parts that are now being served over at Encanto for $28 a plate. Yeah.
Mary Roach, what was the oddest fact you found?
I was unaware that we have a set of internal nostrils. Like when you hold food or wine in your mouth and these wonderful aromas are being released, these gases, these molecules waft up into the top of your nose, and they do that when you're exhaling, you're blowing them up into the nose. So it's called retronasal olfaction. So when you're breathing in and you're using the more well-known set of nostrils, it's orthonasal olfaction, you're sniffing. But when it's wafting up from the back of the mouth to the nose, that's called retronasal olfaction, and you're doing it with your internal nostrils.
Is that how come all of these wine experts can tell 5 different flavors, and those of us who go, oh, this wine's good or bad, can't?
That's what you're using. You're using your internal nostrils. And when they're like swishing it around, chewing the wine, as they say, that's releasing more of those gases, and they're traveling because your mouth is shut. The nose isn't, you know, the exterior nostrils aren't participating, but that's the route. It's going up through the opening in the back of the mouth, and that is how you're experiencing berry and cherry and what all these many, many other chemical combinations that wine tasters can put labels to that I can't put a label to.
Well, when you were finally told about this internal nostril and then you did it make a difference for you?
It makes a tremendous difference in how intense the flavors are and how complex they are. I still can't put a label to them the way somebody in the wine industry can. And that's because that just comes from experience. And also, you train your nose. You can buy these kits that have, say, black cherry. Here's the reference molecule, and you sniff that, and you learn that, and you go, okay, now I can identify that. It's like learning vocabulary for a foreign language. And if you haven't done that, it's very hard to identify a flavor that's black cherry or melon or cucumber or whatever it is. It's hard. You know, we are raised to pay attention to visual cues and put labels to them. We're not really raised to, you know, nobody says, go left at the smell of simmering hot dogs. You know, you see, go left at the birch tree or whatever it is, or the stop sign. We're much more visually oriented.
There's a big chunk of the book having to do with, you know, everything has to be euphemistic at one point or another. So we can call this prison smuggling, if you want to call it that.
Yeah. Well, I think you could say that hooping is the euphemism that they use.
Oh, it is.
Hooping. Hooping, as in through the hoop. Keistering, I like that actually better, keistering.
How did you find Rodriguez, your man on the inside?
Surprisingly enough, through the California Department of Corrections, their public affairs office. I sent them a note, tried to kind of explain what I was up to, because I was looking for a setting for the rectum chapter, and I thought, you know, who rectum is a storage facility, essentially, and I thought, well, who might have an interesting perspective on the rectum as a storage facility and holding things at length in that facility, and what does that do to you? Surprisingly enough, this gentleman wrote back to me right away and said, well, we have a problem at Avenal State Prison with rectal smuggling of cell phones and tobacco. So he set it up. He said, we'll find somebody. We've got a couple candidates who are quite known on the premises, so we will set up a conversation for you with this guy. I remember he said, will 4 hours be enough time for you to talk to a stranger about his rectum? I think so.
I could see as the book continued, because I thought this would be like a half a page, and it goes on. It must have been rather eye-opening to you, because he kept telling you more and more and more and more.
Well, yeah, prison is a boring place. And so if you've got someone from the outside world who wants to have a conversation from a different perspective, and I think he welcomed the opportunity to – it was a diversion to sit down and talk about this stuff with somebody from the outside world. He was serving a life sentence. So I think this kind of broke up the day for him. And also, rectal smuggling is not something you and I practice on a daily basis, but it's very common in prison. So it's kind of it's just part of everyday life. It's not particularly shocking or strange.
And they use double condoms for protection.
Of course.
What was the most pleasing or satisfying fact that you came across in your research, something that made you smile and go, yeah, this is really awesome?
I loved the fact that somebody figured out that when you blush, the lining of your stomach blushes too. Because there is a link between, everybody knows, the emotions in the gut there is a very direct highway between the nervous system and the head and the nervous system and the gut. The gut has its own nervous system, primitive nervous system. That was just a wonderful way to sort of make that connection. This was, again, one of those guys with a hole in his stomach. Different guy. Some of the lining of his stomach was sort of protruding from the hole. And he was a very shy guy, and he would blush easily. And they noticed that his stomach was blushing too.
I was going to ask you, what was the most disgusting thing you found, but there's quite a few. Does any of them stand out?
You know what I found the most disgusting? It's not what you would think. Not even the saliva chapter. It was the chapter on the stomach and on competitive eating. And to me, the most disturbing sight that I encountered in the book is the look on the face of a competitive eater toward the end, where you can tell that they're miserable, they're sweating, everything. Their whole system is telling them, get rid of this. You're about to burst your stomach. You're in the danger zone. They're just miserable, and they have this sort of glassy-eyed stare, and the way they're eating, it is, to me, just this grotesque spectacle that I find very hard to watch. And that, to me, was the most off-putting thing in the book.
I was surprised that your gastroenterologist dismissed probiotics so quickly, because I know that when I took probiotic pills when I went to Thailand, I probably had the best time I had in a foreign country eating the food. So, and I continued with it, and a lot of old problems went away.
Probiotics haven't, and the thing with the fecal transplant is you're putting in a huge, it's a cup and a half of stuff. You need a tremendous amount of the new population to make a dent in the population that's in there. So it's very hard. Also, eating it orally, a lot of what gastric juice does more than digesting food is kill bacteria.
So it's got to be encapsulated in such a way that it doesn't open up till it's in the colon. You've got to also, the bacteria in the colon are mostly anaerobic, so it's very tricky to process them, package them, keep them alive, and get them into the other person and know that they're still alive. It wasn't just Dr. Korutz who did the fecal transplant who said it. It was I talked to the head of research and development at the Probiotics Research Institute in Canada. And he said, 95% of them aren't tested, so they don't have any call to be making the claims that they're making. It's not to say that they're not all, that all of them aren't helping. It's just given how much you're taking and the difficulties of making them, and it's not a cheap thing to do to keep anaerobic bacteria alive in a lab. So that was generally the feeling. It's a cheap enough thing to do. If it makes you feel better, why not?
And you pretty much dismiss most people's gluten intolerance. And I assume that the doctor you spoke with didn't do any research into the fact that, for instance, the wheat we're eating has more gluten than the wheat we ate 30 years ago.
Well, there's actual celiac, which is one thing, which is the rate in the general population is less than 1%. There's talk of something that is not, you can't test with a blood test, you can't really pin it down or quantify it, and that is just something, gluten sensitivity. So that's sort of in a realm unto its own, and nobody really knows how many of those cases are that. The thing with the gut is there's so much going on. It's so emotion related and stress related, and so everybody wants to blame one ingredient for how they feel. And again, if somebody finds that they feel a lot better doing that, then why not? I'm just saying that when people say, I have celiac, very often they don't have that. They have who knows what they have. To a certain extent, society decides what's a disease. And they come and go. And this is the era of gluten sensitivity. There are changes in wheat that could be a possibility. Also, another theory I've heard is that overuse of antibiotics has affected people's internal flora, their bacteria, and that that's contributing to the problem, which has a certain amount of logic to it. So nobody at this point knows, because there's not a specific test anyway in the Western medicine. There's not a specific test for whatever we're calling gluten sensitivity, but it's a different, it's not celiac. It's a different thing.
And you also mentioned the fad that went away, which was fiber.
Yeah, fiber was the buzzword of the 1980s, was it? I guess 70s, 80s. Fiber was everything. That's what I mean when I say society kind of decides. And then when there's money to be made, then you have the large food companies and you see them all getting on board now. Everything is gluten-free, gluten. So they're getting, and so it creates this sort of a massive shift in consciousness, whereas no one thought about gluten before. They thought about fiber or whatever it was, or fat. In the 80s, it was fat. Everything was low fat. Fat was the demon. And then it was carbs. And it shifts around. And
Mary Roach, in looking at your bio and knowing that you deal with a lot of issues that some of us are squeamish about, how much do you think working at the San Francisco Zoo inured you to the ability to deal with this stuff and not constantly be running to the bathroom?
I think when you spend 8 hours a day working next to Gorilla World, you have a very kind of visceral realization that you too are a primate. You are not that far off from those guys over there. It really was. It's a trailer next to Gorilla World, and sometimes people would knock on the door. Is this Gorilla World? I'd say, well, not quite. Almost.
When I interviewed you the first time, it was for Stiff, I believe I asked you if you had a chance, if you would ever try cannibalism just for the sake of it. And you kind of said, yeah, I might.
It depends on the circumstances.
Right.
I certainly would in a shipwreck situation.
Between these books, between all of them, when you look at them and kind of look for the weirdest or the kind of stuff where you go back and you go, wow, I can't believe I did that. in any of these, what comes first to mind?
The ultrasound study, I think, in Bonk, which was a... Bonk is a book about sex labs, really. It's about people taking the study of sexual physiology, putting it in a laboratory scenario, because that's how you study physiology, is you have to have human beings, and that's kind of an awkward thing. And I wanted to write... I wanted to talk to somebody who'd been in a... one of those very intimate studies, like Masters and Johnson had done in the late 50s, and those people are all, their identities were concealed, and that it isn't possible to really talk to them. So I thought, I called up somebody who was doing something contemporary, study, and I said, you know, could I be there? And they said, well, we don't really have any volunteers, so, but you can volunteer. And then I thought, and on the one hand, I thought, this is just really too much information for the reader. It's really weird for me and Ed, my husband. But on the other hand, I thought this is the only way to really say this is what it's like, because it's a very strange situation. And I wanted to be able to communicate that to the readers. And I also thought it was going to be so much fun to write it up. And it was.
When you're creating the book, is there a point where the book is like 500 pages down and 500 pages and you're cutting it to 200? Or is that going on internally before you even write?
Yeah, for me, it's a struggle to get to 300 pages, to find enough material that I think is fun enough or interesting enough, or whatever it is, enough. So no, I'm there's not much on the cutting room floor.
Mary Roach, have you started work on your next project?
I have not. I have a couple ideas I'm investigating now, but it's all very larval.
Because last time, Packing for Mars, you had already started Gulp.
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm running out of ideas, Richard. I've got, like, how much left of the human body is there?
There's always geezer, right?
I know. Yeah, right. Yeah, there is. That's
which
right.
Which we talked about before we went on the air, which would be how the human body ages.
Yeah, I'm thinking that, you know, I'm 54 now, so maybe that's something for a little bit later on when I can relate more fully.
And one final question. As each of these books comes out, they become more and more popular. What do you think is really going on here?
I think with time, every time you have a book come out, there's just more and more people who are familiar with your work. I just think it's a progression. I mean, I've seen that. I love the writer Bill Bryson, and I remember reading his books when nobody knew who he was. And some of my favorite books of his were some of his earlier ones. But at a certain point, his audience grew, and then A Walk in the Woods happened, and suddenly it just seemed like he burst onto the scene. But it was actually a incremental. It's like the more people know you, it just grows.
Do you think it's also the subject matter that you're dealing with this stuff?
I think with Gulp, it is. I think that Gulp has done better than Packing for Mars did its first couple of weeks, I think because everybody has guts and everybody eats. And Packing for Mars, I think there was a perception, oh, space, I'm not interested in that. I found some of the material in Packing for Mars more interesting. Just zero gravity and space is such a surreal and foreign place to be a human being. But it doesn't have an obvious relevance the way the Alimentary Canal does.
Well, you had said when we talked to Packing for Mars that there's actually a progression. Something in one book leads to the other, and as you said, this one leads to a certain section. So now, in that sense, those little notes you have, do they come out of Gulp?
There was a footnote in Bonk that I pulled out at the last second because I thought, oh, this is going in the new book. This is what the new book is about. So I have sometimes yanked a footnote because I realized it was the germ of another book. So what I should do is go and read Gulp again, the footnotes anyway, find the next book, which is probably lurking somewhere unbeknownst to me right under my nose.
You've been listening to an interview with Mary Roach, whose latest book is titled Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. I'm Richard Walensky on BookWaves.